Welcome to the Town Hall Review, brought to you by the Salem Media Group. I'm Hugh Hewitt. President Trump's first 100 days is showing a lot of promise. Is the country hearing about it? And how does Team Trump feel about it?
There's certainly frustrations inside the White House based on my reporting.
If the media are ignoring Donald Trump's victories, conservative pundits and politicos are taking notice.
I think this is a moving occasion. And it's an occasion to affirm that, yes, we really are one country.
An act of decisive leadership. The president's show of force in Syria is applauded as a sign of hope that has been absent for 8 long years.
Still, President Trump, once again, please, sir, what you did was amazing. What you did was a powerful message of hope for a lot of people inside and outside of Syria.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. The first 100 days of a presidency, it's a measurement largely created by the media, and it can put a great deal of pressure on an incoming president. President Trump's first 100 days started off pretty bumpy. Yes, some of that bumpiness was self-imposed, self-inflicted, but much had to do with a press corps that wants to help him fail. My friend Robert Costa from the Washington Post has evaluated this picture as we enter the final third of that 100-day period. He finds our president's record quite impressive. We discuss the president's scorecard on the Hugh Hewitt Show. The 100 days tour I've been on, I've been pointing out President Trump gets Gorsuch, Gorsuch, Gorsuch. He resets American foreign policy with the Syria strike. And he has done 11 pieces of legislation that will rise with the CRA repeals that are coming his way that I don't think many people in the mainstream media quite understand the accomplishment. They get the health care didn't get through. But they don't understand. We've been rolling bill after bill through, and not only do they repeal terrible rules, they bar those agencies from ever going back to that area without explicit congressional consent. Is it frustrating to Team Trump that they're not getting the 100 days credit that they ought to be getting?
There's certainly frustrations inside the White House based on my reporting. I think the health care thing was given such an emphasis, not by the media, but by the White House and by the Republicans in Congress, that some of that frustration still simmers. They're trying to reboot, as you know, in foreign policy, becoming a little more hawkish, traditionally Republican in the approach to Syria and North Korea. And this two-week break that Congress has taken will give them some time to maybe see what they can do on taxes and infrastructure.
Now, Robert Costa, this Syria thing was huge. I want to play for you John Bolton, summarizing it better than anybody else in 40 seconds.
The Obama era for American foreign policy is clearly over. I thought this strike ordered by the president was very measured, very precise, had a very limited rationale because of the use of chemical weapons, but very effective. And I think the message that it sent around the world to adversaries, potential adversaries, China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, well beyond Syria, something that needed to be heard. And I think it's going to change a lot of calculations. I don't think you can underestimate the reverberations that we're going to see from this.
I don't think you can underestimate. I agree with him, Robert Costa. Is that the view that you share, that the Washington Post colleagues share, and that the White House shares?
Well, I think everyone's in a wait-and-see mode. The action taken in Syria is seen as something that could reverberate with China as they look at maybe being a partner in a more forceful way with the United States in dealing with Kim Jong-un in North Korea. There's a question, though, about whether that North Korea is going to be the same template that we've seen in Syria. And there's also a question of is there going to be a second wave in Syria? I know you're deeply involved in the issue, Hugh, but is Trump going to become more of an interventionist, more forceful against the Assad regime, or is this a one-off because of chemical weapons? There are a lot of open questions about what this strike means as it cascades down through policy ranks.
All right, now, Robert, talk to us a little bit about changes at the White House. General McMaster assured people that Steve Bannon, the change is not that big of a deal. And I've seen lots of reporting of the Reince Priebus, Jared, Bannon, meaning. What is going on? You're wired in. You're like hardwired into the West Wing. I think you've got like a little costoscope that's left lying around in Priebus's desk or something. What's going on?
So Bannon and Kushner have been clashing on policy, but they still have a personal rapport, and there's not an enormous split. The president's told them to work it out. The president also, based on my reporting, likes having competing power centers around him. On the national security front, Bannon's still involved. He's still going to meetings. He was part of the Syria discussion, and Bannon still has a close relationship with Pompeo, and Mattis and different people within the top ranks of the administration. But Kushner has been unnerved by how health care went, about the president's popularity, his sinking numbers in the polls. So you have a tension for sure. Reince Priebus is trying to play the mediator, and McMaster is certainly asserting himself on the NSC, saying, I don't want it to be politicized at all. Let me pick my own people.
Finally, Robert Costa, the 100 days is a invention of the media, but it is a powerful invention. And I don't think the White House is very good at telling their story because people don't understand the Congressional Review Act. Are they working on that? Does someone actually have that as a plan to go out there and have the president detail what he's done?
They are. And there's a good piece by our friend Shane Goldmacher at Politico today all about this. And the White House is trying to tout his achievements, what they are, at least in the coming weeks. I think the president, I'm told, wants to get back on the road, have some rallies. And we'll see if he can go to some places that aren't just total Trump areas and maybe try to expand his base.
Two occurrences in the past 2 weeks have served to shore up the president's performance. My Salem colleague Michael Medved was particularly impressed with what occurred at the White House last Tuesday.
There's a question here, which is, where were the Democrats? No, I'm serious. Wouldn't it have been good for the country? Wouldn't it have been good for the Democratic Party if Chuck Schumer had come forward and said something about, okay, the process has worked, now we welcome Judge Gorsuch and we're confident that he will. And maybe if some Democrats had been included in the swearing-in ceremony, wouldn't that have been appropriate? Shouldn't the Supreme Court be beyond partisanship? I do think it's telling that President Trump seemed about as happy as he seemed since he's been president when he got ready to introduce his appointee, Judge Neil Gorsuch, for his swearing-in ceremony earlier today.
I've always heard that the most important thing that a president of the United States does is appoint people, hopefully great people like this appointment, to the United States Supreme Court. And I can say this is a great honor. And I got it done in the first 100 days. That's even nice. You think that's easy?
Okay, he got it done. You know, he's patting himself on the back, but he's Donald Trump. And it seems to me appropriate. And then he took the oath of office. It was administered by Associate Justice Anthony Kennedy. Justice Kennedy was appointed by President Reagan. And not too long after Justice Kennedy was appointed, he had a law clerk named Neil Gorsuch. This is the first time ever in the Supreme Court that a former law clerk has gotten the chance to serve alongside of the justice with whom he clerked. And it's pretty moving. Here was the remarks after he took the oath of office from Justice Gorsuch.
I see before me so many to whom I owe so much. I know I would not be here today without your friendship and support. Thank you all from the bottom of my heart. I want to thank the president for nominating me and for the great confidence and trust he's reposed in me. I want to thank the vice president for his constant encouragement and friendship throughout this process.
Okay, he thanked the president and the vice president. How come he didn't thank any Democrats? Answer, because the Democratic Party didn't even want to give him an up or down vote. They didn't even want to consider the nomination. It's absurd, isn't it? The Republican treatment of Sotomayor and Kagan was not the same. What is this illness that people on the left honestly believe that even a manifestly good man with not a hint of scandal anywhere in his entire life, like Neil Gorsuch, that they seem to believe that someone like this is not worthy of honor and support? Justice Gorsuch continued.
This process has reminded me just how outrageously blessed I am in my law clerks, and my family, and my friends. And I hope that I may continue to rely on each of you as I face this new challenge. To my former colleagues and the wonderful staff of the 10th Circuit, I thank you for your faithful service and your friendship over so many years. To my new colleagues and the staff of the Supreme Court, thank you for the very warm welcome. I look forward to many happy years together. And I cannot tell you how honored I am to have here today my mentor, Justice Kennedy, administer the judicial oath, a beautiful oath, as he did for me 11 years ago when I became a circuit judge.
And then finally, he thanks the Scalia family, which was very much represented there.
I won't ever forget that the seat I inherit today is that of a very, very great man. To my wife, Louise, and my daughters, Emma and Bindi, thank you for your perseverance and your patience, your courage and your love. I simply could not have attempted this without you. And to the American people, I am humbled by the trust placed in me today. I will never forget that to whom much is given, much will be expected. And I promise you that I will do all my powers permit to be a faithful servant of the Constitution and laws of this great nation.
I think this is a moving occasion. And it's an occasion to affirm that, yes, we really are one country. So what is it about the current situation that makes it impossible, virtually impossible, for people on the left to even come together on something like this? It's a feel-good story for once. Why wouldn't we want to make a fresh start, new life, redemption?
When we return.
Still, President Trump, once again, please, sir, what you did was amazing. What you did was a powerful message of hope for a lot of people inside and outside of Syria. I didn't see you in 2013 when 1,400 people were gassed to death. I didn't see you raising your voice against President Obama's...
This man is my hero because this man is saying the opposite of what CNN and the entire left has been saying.
Media's hypocrisy in full bloom when the Town Hall Review continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. If you missed our opening segment, go to townhallreview.com and get the podcast for free. The second action of the new administration that has been met with approval on the left and the right alike was the April 6th U.S. missile strike on Syria. That has also left us watching in apprehension as the story unfolds. Some of that nervousness is to be expected. After all, it's so long since the U.S. did anything particularly decisive in defense or in foreign relations. After the missile strike on Syria, there's a more hopeful picture emerging for the future of the region. Dennis Prager looks at how the incident was treated by America's newspaper of record.
This is from the New York Times. President Trump is a hypocrite for lamenting the deaths of Syrian babies while seeking to bar Syrian refugees from the United States. It's a fantastic statement. I mean, it in the sense of fantasy. So let me understand. You have to be for bringing in 100,000 or so, 60, 80, 100,000 Syrians into the United States to show that you really care about Syrians. Fighting on their behalf is not enough. So I'm curious, Mrs. Clinton, was Barack Obama a hypocrite for wanting to bring in 100,000 Syrians but not doing anything on their behalf in Syria? Is that a fair question? But it wouldn't have occurred to her because her thought process is attack Donald Trump and defend Barack Obama. You want to hear the response to this, by the way? There is a response to her charge, and it's given by a Syrian. I saw this, and I have to admit, I think CNN was shocked that this man said this. This is a man, a Syrian named Qassam Eid, or Eid, or Eid, E-I-D.
We cannot in one breath speak of protecting Syrian babies and in the next close America's doors to them.
quickly, Qasem, how do you see that?
With all due respect, I didn't see each and every person who was demonstrating after the travel ban. I didn't see you 3 days ago when people were gassed to death, when civilians were gassed to death. I didn't see you in 2013 when 1,400 people were gassed to death. I didn't see you raising your voice against President Obama's...
This man is my hero because this man is saying the opposite of what CNN and the entire left has been saying.
If you really care about refugees, if you really care about helping us, please help us stay in our country. We don't want to come to the United States. We want to stay in our country. We want to stay in our country. With all due respect, this is hypocrisy. If you really care, help us stay in our country. We don't want to become refugees. We want to stay in our country. Help us establish safe zones. Help us stay safe
I'm
in
sure
our country.
I'm sure she's delighted she had him on.
Just to tell President Trump once again, please, sir, what you did was amazing. What you did was a powerful message of hope for a lot of people inside and outside of Syria. Please don't stop on this. Please help Syrians stay in their country. Please establish safe zones. Please take out Assad air forces so they won't be able to commit more atrocities using traditional weapons. 500,000 people were killed with traditional weapons, just so people can know what we have suffered in the past 6 years.
Well, that was great. That was great. The inaction of 6 years. And how come you guys never demonstrated? God, is this guy good or is this guy good?
The use of nerve gas in Syria, sarin, and the U.S. response has understandably dominated much of the news coverage over the course of the last week. But the inquiry into the unmasking scandal, the Obama administration, and National Security Advisor Susan Rice's scandal continues to unfold. I invited former U.S. Prosecutor Andrew McCarthy back on my program to look deeper at what has been termed a potentially Watergate-level scandal. I just tweeted out, up now, Andrew C. McCarthy on the domestic spying of Susan Rice, hashtag Susan Rice. Is it a fair way for me to characterize Susan Rice, domestic spy?
Well, we don't know that quite yet, Hugh, but it certainly looks like it could trend in that direction. You know, the thing I try to caution people about this story, which I think is potentially a Watergate-level scandal, is that if you're looking for crime here other than the leaking of classified information to the media, which is a serious felony crime, they're going to be hard to come by because we're dealing here in the gray area of regulation and minimization instructions and guidelines. This is more like what you find in, for example, the second impeachment article of the Nixon impeachment, where Congress talked about the misuse of the FBI and the CIA and the IRS to investigate or to invade people's privacy and infringe on their constitutional rights. Not necessarily a crime, but it's not really the issue of whether something is technically a violation of a penal law is beside the point when you're putting it up against abuse of power, which is actually a much more heinous offense.
The abuse of power, which was at the heart of the Nixon impeachment, is with what I am most familiar. And it does not necessarily involve the breaking of law. It does involve the abuse of power, and it's a political crime. That's why domestic spying, as I phrase it, is not actually a felony anywhere. Leaking is a felony. We do have felonies out there. But the idea that there are out there spreadsheets of every contact and call that Trump associates had, and I don't know that that's been confirmed yet. That's an allegation that people are working on. That brings to mind Charles Colson and the plumbers. And I know these guys. Charles Colson was a buddy of mine. And it gives you shudders. That's police state stuff.
Well, it runs inconsistent to what their storyline has been all along, which is that there's nothing to see here because these are incidental interceptions. Now, when you sit down, and again, you're quite right to be cautious about this. If this happened, but if it did happen, and you're talking about spreadsheets, it becomes very hard to accept the premise that the interceptions were incidental.
How would you conduct a questioning of Susan Rice, Andrew, and maybe you'll write this over the weekend so that our knuckleheads in Congress don't screw this up when either she or Ben Rhodes or anyone who can be called is called.
I think you that what you would do is the first thing that's important for them is they have to get these documents before they speak to her. And, you know, for her, from her standpoint, that would probably be better, too.
The alleged spreadsheets? You mean the alleged spreadsheets or the raw intelligence?
I mean the alleged spreadsheets, but I also would be, they have records of every time somebody asks for an unmasking.
Okay.
So my first question is this a one-off or, you know, two times? Look, I was a prosecutor who worked with FBI agents for a long time. During the course of that, I made the legal decisions, they made the investigative decisions, but there were lots of times that I missed something legally that they tipped me off to, and that they missed something investigatively that I tipped them off to. So it can happen. And as a result, if it was one or two times that she did it, and there was a plausible reason for it from an intelligence standpoint, and I think, you know, the Russian thing is very serious. I don't think they hacked the election, but Russia's a hostile to our interests. So, you know, looking into Russia, I wouldn't blame them for that. But is this something that happened one or two times innocently, or is it a pattern of behavior that somehow incidentally, in quotes, involved the same exact people again and again, all of whom had connection with Trump?
Coming up.
I think it was exactly the right thing to do. It was a very precise, limited, targeted response to the Syrian government's use of chemical weapons in the Syrian civil war.
John Bolton and the far-reaching impact of Trump's Syria strike. When the Town Hall Review continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Earlier, Dennis Prager looked at the human impact of the U.S. missile strike on Syria and how it has given hope to Syrians in the grip of a brutal civil war. The political effect of this strike is still being measured. We'll be watching closely to see if the fruits of Secretary of State Tillerson's meeting with President Vladimir Putin in Moscow earlier this week are indeed real. Mike Gallagher recently caught up with John Bolton, the former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, now with the American Enterprise Institute.
The latest news on top of the Swedish terror attack, where somebody apparently plowed a truck into a crowd of people in Stockholm, and of course the news about the U.S. airstrikes, now comes word that a Russian warship entered the eastern Mediterranean a few hours ago and was heading towards the area where two U.S. Navy destroyers launched these missile strikes into Syria. This is Fox News reporting this. The Russian warship is now in the eastern Mediterranean, steaming in the direction of the U.S. warships. Is that and a lot of people are alarmed by this news. Let me put it to you. Is this cause for deep concern, or is Putin just strutting and bluffing a little bit here?
Well, I think you obviously have to watch any naval vessel that's coming close to our forces. Remember, the Russians have long had a naval base at Tartus in Syria.
Right.
In fact, when the Soviet Union broke up in 1991, Tartus was the only Russian military base outside the territory of the former Soviet Union. So it's a very important base for them. And the fact that this Russian ship is now reported in the Eastern Med indicates it was probably on the way yesterday or the day before. Obviously, it has to come through the Dardanelles and the Bosporus out of the Black Sea.
Right.
Down into the Mediterranean. So I think this was probably already on schedule. But, you know, we'll have to see what other assets the Russians have at Tartus and whether they're preparing for a possible response. That was part of the risk involved in this decision by the president. I think it was well worth taking. But now we'll see what the Russian response is.
And, of course, the president has demonstrated to the world that he's capable of making a strong, decisive decision like this. I believe that when the United States shows strength, the world is a safer place. This has been, though, an interesting journey because it wasn't that long ago that the president seemed reluctant to engage in such a military act. But it seems to me that he is getting widespread support for what happened in Syria.
Yeah, look, I think it was exactly the right thing to do. It was a very precise, limited, targeted response to the Syrian government's use of chemical weapons in the Syrian civil war. You know, Syria is a party to the Chemical Weapons Convention, so is the United States.
It's designed to prevent the use or the spread of chemical weapons. And I think, as the president said, whenever a country violates its commitments not to use weapons of mass destruction, that's a threat to the national security of the United States, even if the targets are not American citizens. So this doesn't necessarily tell us anything about what may come next in the Syrian civil war, what the next American action will be. But I think it's it is a signal that people all around the world have seen and heard. The reaction from our friends is overwhelmingly positive. I think they're breathing a sigh of relief. They weren't sure what the Trump administration would do, and they understand this is what American leadership means. So I think if you look at the correspondingly at the negative responses from Russia, Iran, North Korea, sort of all the usual suspects, that tells you a lot of what you need to know. And the particular coincidence of the president ordering this strike and then having dinner with Chinese President Xi Jinping will certainly add to their discussions last night and today, that's for sure.
Well, this is the one guy that perhaps has influence over over the North Korea dictator, right? I mean, so for the Chinese president to be in dining with the with our president when this happens, that's a pretty profound thing.
Right, and there's no doubt that the North Korean nuclear weapons program is going to be a big topic of conversation. President Trump had already signaled that, and the fact is, North Korea, as our own military experts estimate, is very, very close to the dangerous point where they can miniaturize a nuclear device, put it under the nose cone of an ICBM, and in the very near future hit targets in the United States. So that leaves us with some pretty unpleasant options to be sure we can defend the United States, protect it against a possible attack from this irrational regime in North Korea. Mm-hmm. We might be pushed to the point where we'd have to strike in North Korea preemptively, and if anybody doubted our willingness to do it, the events should eliminate that. So I think Xi Jinping, the Chinese president, now has an opportunity to have a serious discussion with President Trump on this issue of why China needs to do what China has the unique capacity to do, is put pressure on North Korea to end its nuclear weapons program entirely.
Coming up,
I believe that this is going to get on the floor in the next couple of weeks, and we will be successful, and we will be able to rescue the American people from a very onerous health care bill.
Budget Chairwoman Diane Black on the death spiral of Obamacare in Tennessee when the Town Hall Review returns. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. The Budget Committee of the U.S. House of Representatives is a key cog in evaluating legislation that can help fix the rubble left by the prior administration. High on the list is still repeal and replace Obamacare, the complex and critical fix our ailing health care system so desperately need. As chair of the committee, Tennessee Congresswoman Diane Black has marshaled her 30-plus committee members in this huge responsibility. I recently spoke with Congresswoman Black on the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Which of your bills is headed to the president's desk?
It is the CRA bill that would repeal the rule that the president put in having to do with Title X funding.
Now, a lot of people, I tried to explain to them, Donald Trump's first 100 days is defined by Neil Gorsuch, by the strike on Syria, which ended in an era of American passivity. But I think he's had 11 CRA laws, soon to be 12, 13. Tell us about yours and then generally about what this, because the media just doesn't understand this. Or is just ignorant about it?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think we have to explain what a CRA is. It's the Congressional Review Act, and it is what gives us an opportunity when a president is leaving office for the days that he leaves, before he leaves office, he will put things in place that, you know, he believes that he can't get through the Congress, so he just puts in place by rule. And that's what he did on this Title X, and Title X dollars are dollars that come from the federal government down to states, allowing them to be able to use for family planning that money in their state. And for the last 45 years, since Title X dollars have been available, states have had the prerogative to decide where to best use those dollars. We in the state of Tennessee decided a long time ago, and I was in the state legislature when we decided this, that the money would come to the Department of Health. They would make that decision about where to send the money. We didn't defund Planned Parenthood. We just felt like the other facilities, like the federally qualified health centers, the health departments, gave more comprehensive care. And so by the time it got to people like Planned Parenthood, there was no money left, and we were had the prerogative to do that. Essentially what the president did with his rule is to take that away from us, and I believe that it was a gift to the big abortion industry to say that states now are going to be forced to use their money in the way in which the federal government says, i.e., you must give it to abortion clinics.
And so when you repeal this, I believe the CRA acts that they may not return in the future and do it again. It's a one and done. This is no more backdooring of Planned Parenthood funding via the regulatory state anymore.
Exactly, Hugh. And that is one of the most exciting things about it, is that another president just can't come in and overturn this. They must take it before the legislative body if they want to return to what Obama did by rule.
Now,
it's a very exciting thing for us to have happen.
Representative Black, my friends at the Pacific Legal Institute at redtaperollback.com have made an argument that not only can you go back 60 legislative days, as you and the president and your colleagues have done a dozen times already, making this one of the most significant 100 days legislatively ever, but that you can go back further if a report was not filed by the regulatory agency appropriately. Are you, and there's controversy about that. That's not a done deal. It's controversial. Are you eager to test that? Do you think we ought to go find one that comes back but was not reported on adequately to the Congress and see if the CRA doesn't effectively repeal that as well?
Well, I think the most important thing is for us to look at those rules that were put in and to see where they affect the American people. And if there is one that does such an act where it really is onerous and keeps businesses from operating, big industries from operating, then we need to go back and look at that. I don't know of any of those right now, but that's not to say that they're not there.
Now, Representative Black, talk to us a little bit about health care. Last time you were on the show, we were talking about the Budget Committee. You passed resolutions. You gave guidance to the Rules Committee. A rule came out, it did not muster support. Is this dead? Because I think the reconciliation instructions only give you to May to get this thing done.
Well, the reconciliation instructions allow us to be able to continue with this reconciliation until we pass another budget. And we are working on that in the Budget Committee, and I'm excited about having such great members that want to really actually do the things that we need to do on the budget. But, no, we're not done, and this is just the beginning. And look, I'm disappointed that it didn't come to the floor, but when you're making law, it is a messy thing. I always tell people it's kind of like sausage, and I've actually made sausage. It's not very pretty when you're making it, but it tastes good when it's done. And that's what we're in the process of doing. We thought we had a really good bill. There were some members who felt that it didn't do as much as they would like to, so we stopped the process. We listened. We're reforming it, making it better. And I believe that this is going to get on the floor in the next couple of weeks, and we will be successful, pass it over to the Senate, let them put their little finishing touches on it, and we will be able to rescue the American people from a very onerous health care bill.
You know, I made the statement on Meet the Press 2 weeks ago that Obamacare within a death spiral, and one of my exhibits is Tennessee, where 3 out of 4 counties have one provider. PolitiFact said that was false. What do you think about Obamacare in Tennessee? Is it in a death spiral?
Oh, absolutely. Not only do we have 2/3 of our counties that only have one provider, we now have 14, I think it's up to 15 counties in the eastern part of our state that have no health care, no insurance providers on the exchange. They're gone. And they're not coming back until we change things. 63% increase in premiums. This is just something that people can't afford, and they may have a card, but that doesn't mean that they have care when the deductible is somewhere between $5,000 and $10,000. People in my district have an average income of $45,000. There's no way that you can afford on a yearly basis a $5,000 to $10,000 deductible. So we need to rescue the American people, and especially in my state, I'm very concerned about what's going to happen with this insurance.
My biggest disappointment with President Trump in the first 100 days is that he promised a 350-ship Navy, and the Director Mulvaney budget and the supplemental does not even add a full ship. We're going to be 44 short under this. What about a supplemental? What about plussing up the Navy? This is simply not what he promised. He promised a 350-ship Navy, and it's not in that budget.
We have not received the supplemental from the president yet. We are waiting for that. We are a conference who believes strongly in a strong military, and we know that the military has been hollowed out, so we are waiting to hear what he has to say. And I'm working with Matt Thornberry on looking at what we can do with the supplemental to make sure that our military is as ready as we can possibly make them at this time. We know that over the last 8 years that this administration, the Obama administration, really did not care about the military. So we've got a lot of catching up to do. We won't be able to do it in 1 year, but we do intend on having our military plussed up and ready.
If you missed part of the conversation with Chairwoman Black, go to townhallreview.com and sign up for a podcast of the entire program. Coming up, mindless rebellion spreads.
When a Facebook call goes out to say, shut down the white supremacist fascists, you have to take it seriously these days.
Heather McDonald in the final segment of the Town Hall Review after this. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Black Lives Matter. That hashtag began to spread after the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. And it spread to Baltimore and far beyond, and it's ignited college campuses across the country. Some people believe that Black Lives Matter activists were behind the recent violence at Middlebury College in Vermont, targeting distinguished scholar and author Charles Murray. Last week, again, some believed that Black Lives Matter showed up at the equally private college in Claremont, California, Claremont McKenna College, directed at another distinguished writer, researcher, and truth-teller. Here's Mike Gallagher with Heather McDonald of the Manhattan Institute.
Did you expect this was going to happen when you went to Claremont, California?
Only a day before, I got an urgent email from an administrator who was organizing, saying they'd gotten wind of protests and we're thinking then about changing the venue to a building with less plate glass windows and better egress. So that was a little worrisome. They decided to keep the venue because on the day of the speech they hadn't heard further Facebook agitation. Well, that was a big mistake. When a Facebook call goes out to say, shut down the white supremacist fascist, you have to take it seriously these days. And there was police presence outside, but it was feckless police presence. Police, especially campus police, don't want to upset the student darlings. You know, we have a consumerist model of education, but also campus police generally are second-guessing themselves thanks to the Black Lives Matter false narrative. So the students, there were almost 300, managed a total blockade of the building where I was supposed to speak. I had to be shuttled in through secret passageways. I did speak to an empty room, and it was live-streamed. To me, this is at least proto-fascism, if not outright fascism. They not only shut me down, which I don't mind, but they were exercising brute force over their fellow students and deciding, you do not have the right to interact with me in person, ask me questions. And that is just an extraordinary assumption of power that is not being checked. I confess that when I was in my safe house before the speech, and I couldn't see what was happening, but I could hear it. Mm. I could hear the mob grow. I could hear the chanting. I could hear the female hysterical voices rising above.
What were they chanting?
Hey, hey, ho, ho, Heather Mack has got to go.
Wow.
Of course, the usual F the police. And the most hilarious one was, down with race. CMC is racist. Claremont McKenna College is racist.
For letting you speak.
Well, for letting me speak, right. But, of course, many minority students at CMC, traditionally, CMC has had a 200-point SAT gap of racial preferences in favor of blacks and minorities to get them on campus. The idea that CMC is racist is just part and parcel of this delusional victim ideology that is being perpetrated by the left on campuses.
Thank you for joining us for the Town Hall Review. Follow us on Twitter at Town Hall Review and sign up for a podcast of our program at townhallreview.com. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Join us again next week for another edition of Town Hall Review, the Week in Review program from a perspective you can trust.